Hey everybody, this is Sam Davies, and you're listening to Carbon Neutral Convos, presented by the John Molson Sustainable Enterprise Committee, a podcast that tries to bridge a gap between sustainability and business and gets down to the pressing issues facing our world today. We enjoy interviews with guests from a variety of industries and discuss how we can improve on climate action and build a blueprint for a sustainable economy. Today we are joined by Lucas Fraser, a John Molson alumni and co-founder of Breeze, a platform for businesses to measure, reduce, and share their carbon emissions. We hope you enjoy.
Hey, Sam.
Hey, Lucas. Welcome to the podcast. We're glad to have you on.
Glad to be here. Nice to see you again.
Yeah, likewise. So how's the past week been? How have you been? I think you're based in Ontario, so have you been hit by that like snowstorm and whatnot? Or
Yeah, and I actually just moved to Montreal in the last week, back to Montreal after going to Concordia a couple years ago and graduating in 2019. And I'm super excited to be back. But yeah, we've been hit by this snowstorm as well. Yesterday morning, I saw a guy cross-country skiing down the sidewalk to get to work. It was pretty great.
Right. Yeah, so that's a rude awakening back to Montreal, I guess. Yeah.
But the week's been good.
Okay, great. Great. Yeah, so without further ado, let's get into it. I guess we'll give the listeners sort of an idea of, like, who you are, like, how you got in the position you're at, sort of, like, career background, just so they're familiar with like why you decided to start an initiative like Breeze, which I'm really excited to talk about later on in the podcast. I really want to talk about that app and what it can do for clients and whatnot. So I'm really excited to get that conversation going. But before, I think we'll just start with a little bit of career background and sort of, I guess I'll start by asking sort of why did you decide to start a business right out of university rather than taking a job? Like what sort of gave you that, like, that comfort and that, like, what experiences allowed you to like pursue something like that on your own?
So first of all, I gotta say I'm super happy to be here. I've listened to all the episodes of this podcast and I think you guys are doing a great job, and I'm a huge fan of JSEC and everything that you guys continue to do. It was definitely a risky decision and one that, you know, continues to have a positive impact on my life and also give me heck all the time. What it came down to was when I was in university, when I started, I had no idea what I wanted to do, what my skills were, what my interests were. I just kind of joined JMSB and tried to figure it out as I went. And through that process, I ended up having a couple different jobs throughout university, working part-time while I was in full-time school. The first one was working for a private equity firm where I was doing, you know, we were doing investments in tech companies, so like large established enterprise technology companies, where we would acquire and manage these businesses. And so it taught me a lot about just kind of the ins and outs of how business works, how growth works, how acquisition works, and kind of the human element behind all of that, something that I hadn't really seen much of up until that point. But through all that position, I was doing accounting for them for the most part, and I just knew that I wasn't loving the actual job itself. I connected really well with the founder and really well with the teammates and loved kind of the process, but I just didn't really feel like I fit into the job. And so from there, the next job I ended up getting was in marketing, and I actually worked for a company in clean tech in Montreal that was kind of working in the renewable energy space as their digital marketing manager. And again, loved the company, really connected with the founder and had a really interesting time there. Learned a lot about the solar industry, renewable energy, digital marketing, but didn't feel like the job was the right thing for me. And so my last try before figuring out that I was not destined to have a regular job, that I was kind of bound to be an entrepreneur, was in my last summer, I ended up getting an internship with Tesla for their digital marketing team. Out of nowhere, I just applied on a regular application portal, really resonated with the recruiting manager. So I actually spent my summer in San Francisco working at the Tesla headquarters, doing marketing, driving Teslas. It was amazing. But even through all that, I felt like my impact as an individual and employee felt limited relative to what I knew was possible. And at the time, especially, I mean, we were working in electric cars, driving renewable transportation, but my job was in marketing and they didn't seem to have any jobs that fit me in terms of sustainability specifically and sustainability as a strategy. So I knew I wanted to be moving more towards that. And so before knowing what I wanted to do to start my company, in my last couple of years, partly aided by my work with JSEC, partly aided by my work with these kind of sustainable businesses, and through a lot of kind of self-study and discovery, I knew that I needed to work in sustainability. And I had seen firsthand through reading, through talking to founders and innovators, through going to conferences, that sustainability was becoming a competitive advantage for companies. If you could truly understand your footprint, start to reduce it in meaningful ways, and then communicate that really, really well to your customers, to your investors, to your employees, it could be this huge driver of energy and growth and innovation in an organization. And I knew that by communicating that right, by building the right model, we could create that in organizations that were interested. And so we started off right away, jumping straight into consulting right out of university. Me and a partner from JMSB and an environmental engineer that I knew. And so it was kind of the combination of knowing that I wanted to build something of my own, that I wasn't going to fit or, you know, work well in an ordinary job, and seeing clearly and knowing deep down that there was an opportunity and there was a need for more sustainable business in Montreal and beyond.
No, it's amazing. Like, it's really neat to see like all these experiences sort of culminate together and sort of like lead you in a direction. So like saying like you weren't really finding yourself within like private equity and whatnot, but it seems like those experiences are like integral to actually getting to the point where you're at now. And like, yeah, would you say that like those experiences are sort of like necessary if someone wants to be like an entrepreneur? Or like, is there anything like that that you'd say is sort of like key in leading you down this path? Or did you just like always sort of know that you wanted to be an entrepreneur?
Yeah, so I definitely didn't always know. I feel like there have been hints at it, that it might be the kind of thing that I wanted to do or the direction that I wanted to go with my career. But it was never very clear to me until I had kind of exhausted all my other options. And in line with that, my advice to people who are not necessarily certain on where they want their career to go or not sure, you know, whether they want to join a company, start a business, whatever it is try and join companies. If you can try to get roles, whether they're part-time, full-time, you know, it can be challenging, but if you can find your way to get a foot in the door, it's an amazing learning opportunity, whether it's through learning that you don't want to do that or learning the ins and outs of a particular industry. I think there's a huge amount of value to just trying. And then also just doing a lot of individual research and self-study and talking to people.
Right. No, definitely. Yeah. Like we've sort of been talking about like experiences right now, but like, what about like maybe your experiences at JMSB or maybe with JSEC, that like, did those, where there's certain like key experiences on that side, more of your academic career that sort of led you down this path or sort of aided you on your path towards like starting this initiative and whatnot?
Yeah. I think so. Definitely. And two big ones happened at Concordia. I mean, the two biggest influences, I think, both, you know, pushing me towards sustainability and entrepreneurship and just general influences on my development as a person, were working on JSEC and doing case competitions through JMCC. Those two things were amazing. I encourage anybody who's listening to this, who's at JMSB, do case competitions. I'm pretty sure they've come up before in this podcast, as well as join JSEC or join some sort of student association, because what it really is you're putting yourself in the position to spend your days and nights with other people who are interested in the same thing that you're interested in and ambitious and want to start a career and want to build their lives around that. That's incredible. And then on top of that, it provides you a framework to meet professionals who are doing this full time, who have succeeded in finding a career that might be the perfect one for you, and who can guide you in ways that self-study, reading blogs, you know, even professors can't necessarily do. So I think getting that foot into the real world is very important. And then surrounding yourself with other people who are interested in the same topics and interested in pushing themselves to grow and develop. And so JSEC was a huge part of that, where we would organize events. And I was doing business development or sponsorships for JSEC. And that was basically being the person in the organization who was reaching out to as many companies and representatives as I could in Montreal and trying to see if they would want to take part in our event, if they had any sustainable activities, and also seeing if they had anybody who was interested in being a speaker at some of those events and could come in and represent that knowledge. And so it really gave me a chance to connect with some really interesting people who are still, an important part of my life and my work today.
No, I definitely resonate with that, especially like with my experience within JSEC. Like you're saying, like you sort of find the people that sort of share your same interests and sort of like are all like driven to like learn about like whatever topic you're engaged in, whether it be sustainability or whatnot. It really puts you in that like in that group and in that environment where you could really like find yourself, find your way within a certain career or within whatever you like and actually like truly chase it. And like I said, it provides that environment where you could actually like, you know, try out what you like, try out what you don't like. And really, and like you're saying with regards to like growing your network, yeah, like since I've joined JSEC, I've met like countless people that I would have never gotten the opportunity to have met. And like those connections, just they're so valuable. And being able to like talk to people that have, you know, these really substantial, sustainable careers and being able to learn from them has provided so much value for me. And it's like really guided me on like where I want to take my career. And yeah, on the same side with your talk about JMCC and like case competitions, I've yet to like get involved in sort of that aspect. But I will say I've gone to a few like job interviews where one of the requirements is that you do a case. And oh my gosh, I'm just out to dry because like I don't have the framework that like JMCC can provide for you to how to like crack like a case. And like it could really open so many more doors for me. But, you know, like it's just there's so much value in that. And yes,
and it's not the only way you can get those skills.
For sure.
But I completely agree. And the biggest thing that they do incredibly well that they harp on continuously is that you have to just practice every, you know, constantly, one or two or three times a week. You're often sitting down for 3 to 4 hours doing a case, presenting it and getting feedback. And so there's that the natural result of practice is that you improve. You get better at seeing the story through all of the noise and minutia, and you get to the important bits, the important, you know, the points at which the whole case turns, the key problem in there. And that's the biggest part. I mean, something that's often forgotten is the most important part of finding a solution to something is defining the problem. And so learning to define the problem clearly in a case, to see the true crux of it, and then work on building a solution once you've actually defined it well, is huge. And it's something that practice contributes a lot to. And then the other side is when you're forced to give a 20-minute presentation after only a couple hours of prep, and you have to do it with confidence and you have to do it with clarity, you learn to communicate better. You learn to pause. You learn to tell a better story rather than focusing on an incredibly well-developed comprehensive plan with all the details. You learn that, you know, the persuasion, the consistency and the clarity is almost more important.
No, definitely, for sure. Like sort of like being not like thrown out into the fire, but sort of like having like forcing you to like just like seek that experience and just sort of go for it, even though you don't know if you're right or wrong or whatever, just actually like pursuing that. Yeah, no, I hear like crazy stories about people in case comps where they're like, I had no idea what I was talking about for 5 minutes, but I figured it out like on stage or like as they're presenting.
Yeah.
And it's just, it's unreal. Yeah. And like,
we're doing like PowerPoint karaoke,
right?
Somebody gives you a deck and you just have to present on the deck that you've never seen before. It's pretty fun.
Right. Right. It's
such a nerdy business school game, but it is actually a super good time.
Right. Right. I think it needs to sort of like lose that sort of perception, if you will, to get more people involved. But yeah, no, definitely everybody that I speak to who has experiences in that is just, they say it's so invaluable. And like what you're mentioning before about like finding like, just when you're looking at a case or just whatever business issue, like whether it be in the real world or not, like you're saying, you just find those like 4 to 5 issues. And I think that's really important when you're looking at like sustainable issues, right? And like, you just need to find like the 4 to 5 issues with a company that could like help them reach that next step. And would you say that like that experience sort of like, or maybe your time with JMCC, did you see that it would help you with like sort of a sustainable career, sustainable consulting? Was there even sort of a sustainable, I know now JMCC, I think, has a sustainable like team, if you will. I don't know if it had that at that point, but.
I think the year that I was competing, or my first year there competing, it didn't exist. And then the second year I competed, they had just created it.
Okay.
And I wasn't on it. I was just coaching at that point, or for the most part coaching. I wish I had been able to compete on that. They've had some growing pains on that team because it is often hard to define the problem and hard to build a case that makes sense, because sustainability itself is so new relative to, you know, strategy or accounting or these other fields where the problems and solutions are a little bit more well known and well defined at a high level. So you can point people in the right direction. Whereas sustainability cases would be, I mean, as it is to be a consultant to some extent, especially if you're working with large organizations. It could be anything from water insecurity to, you know, social issues to carbon accounting and certification to product sustainability. You know, you can go 100 different ways, and sometimes it's more marketing heavy or more quantification heavy or financial heavy or communications, you know, whatever it might be. So it can be, it can definitely be a challenge, but it's really interesting to get your head into that.
Right.
And that did help a lot in building the consulting. I think to some extent it made me overconfident.
Okay.
I launched my company and I was like, we know how to do all this stuff and we know how to pitch. And then we got our first client and we realized that there's a lot more to it than giving good presentations when nobody's writing the case for you.
Right.
And obviously, you know, there's an oversimplification, but we were definitely more confident than we should have been. And our first client really kind of knocked us down and made us realize the fact that this isn't always straightforward. Defining the problem isn't always easy. And even things like getting engagement and, you know, offering solutions when you haven't properly done some baseline assessment. Like, there's so many different ways that things can go wrong. And it takes a lot of practice and wisdom in the real world as well to get to the point where you can actually deliver value and actually, you know, help clients rather than just kind of be a voice in the room.
Right. And I think what I'm sort of like diluting from that is sort of like it's experience that allow you to sort of like sort of interpret data, interpret like large measurables that you can find within a company and sort of like relay them to a client or whoever you're working with. And that's sort of something that I think Breeze does, right? Is that like you work a lot with data and try to like relay that to your clients. So say, okay, these are where you're at. And then sort of like, what makes you think that like data is such a good starting point for companies who want to like reduce their impact? And why did you take sort of your business in sort of a data centric, like direction, if you will?
Yeah. Yeah. Great questions. And it's something that's constantly evolving. I don't think we're at a final stage of the platform whatsoever. I think there's a lot that we still want to accomplish, but the reason that we started with data and specifically carbon and greenhouse gas related data. So Breeze is essentially in its current form, a carbon accounting platform that's designed to help you find what your most significant impacts are and work towards reducing them. And we decided to go that direction because the long-term goal is to be a platform that is, you know, the go-to solution for companies who are inspired to become more sustainable, to do better, to become climate leaders, to become sustainability leaders. And what that is, you know, it has to start from an understanding of the current situation. What are your impacts? What are your energy and fuel sources? Are you dependent on fossil fuels? And currently the answer for every business in the world is essentially yes. And if so, where can you find opportunities to reduce that? And how can we help you get there? I mean, it's the first step in any solid sustainability program to do a baseline assessment. You map your organization, you map your supply chain, you interview different members of your organization as part of your stakeholder assessment, a materiality assessment, if you're doing it the best, you know, the best in class way. And then immediately, once you've done that stakeholder assessment, you know what your most significant issues are from a qualitative standpoint and from a stakeholder standpoint. Then you dive in and you start collecting data so you can determine the actual quantitative situation. Because you might think your biggest impact is one thing and it turns out to be another. And then if you've built your strategy on an unquantified solution, you have, you know, no leg to stand on. You're just spinning your wheels, wasting your time, wasting your money, and that's not going to get you anywhere. So taking that first step, which is getting faster and faster and more efficient, taking that first step to measure your core impacts, specifically your scope 1 and 2 greenhouse gas emissions, is an amazing place to start. And then to expand from there to scope 3, to some water, waste, you know, non-GHG impacts, that's the best way that you can get started, because then you have evidence, you have data to support whatever strategy that you're going to develop from there. And once you've applied a strategy, once you've started to implement projects to reduce those impacts, you can see whether or not they're working. And for one thing, continue to focus on the areas that are working and move on from the areas that aren't. And on top of that, share successes in a much more real, a much more verifiable way. So I think that that's why we started on data, because it really becomes this literal platform upon which you can build a whole sustainability program. And without it, you know, without a foundation, it just becomes too shaky and too, you know, insecure. And it becomes really hard for anybody to trust the work that you're doing if you're not quantifying it.
No, I definitely agree. And like what I take from that is sort of like data is something that people in business or whatever already have like methods of interpreting, and it's something that's not really so unfamiliar to anybody. So if you're sort of able to apply that within sustainability, which we haven't really seen so much, we're sort of like always too shy to put like a measurable towards sustainability. And if it actually accurately represents the firm's initiative and relates it properly to say financial performance, if you will, sort of like, so just really sort of diluting what a company does to like data and really relaying that to them is just a great way for them to like, okay, here, I've seen this before in other areas. Okay, now I sort of understand what, you know, a 10%, you know, like gain in emissions is, you know, like they understand that. Like it's a pretty intuitive thing to understand.
Right.
So it's just really a great way to sort of interpret your sustainable impact. And I think what Breeze does is sort of puts that in a more like digestible way. And I think that's really important when it comes to like large data sets. It's just like, is this digestible? Will the client or whoever be able to comprehend this and allow them to like sort of do something with that information? And I think that's kind of what Breeze is trying to do.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And doing it in a way that doesn't cost a lot of money or take a huge amount of time. Because everything that you just said is completely true, where you have to start somewhere, you have to communicate it in a good way. And it is something, it is a point that has been lacking in a lot of sustainability programs, analysis, communications, is the hard data behind it. And when there is data reported, it's often kind of buried at the end of reports or split out into text boxes that it's kind of hard to compare. And while, you know, regulations, disclosure frameworks are doing as much as they can to kind of combat that and make it visible, transparent, and comparable, there's still some room to grow there. Yeah, exactly.
Okay, great. Yeah, and sort of one thing I'm sort of unsure about with the Breeze app, it's sort of like how it's kind of like, I don't know, a two-way street, or if you will, sort of the company sort of provides the data, and then sort of like you guys basically apply it in a certain way that you could then relay it back to them and they interpret it however they like. But sort of how do you ensure that they're actually providing accurate data that is actually comparable to other firms that are using the app? Sort of just one thing that sort of maybe like my initial thought about the app, like how do you ensure they're providing actual accurate data that truly reflects whatever their emissions are?
Yeah. So at the end of the day, a company is always responsible for not making things up and not doing things in an unreliable way. We don't communicate data from our customers to anybody outside of the platform or use it for anything. The company's data is their own. And if they choose to then take that and report it, that's their choice. But then they have to do that in a way that they can stand behind. So the first way I'll say is that from day one, it's always encouraged that you start with real world actual data. So we're talking about for energy consumption, this is utility bills that say exactly how much electricity is being used at your various sites around the world. For fuels, it's how much is being consumed, what type of equipment it's being burned in, all that information that's critical for calculating emissions. And so if they're going to be inputting this information and basing their greenhouse gas assessments and reporting on it, it's kind of their job to ensure that that quality is there. And we do as much as we can to help. We provide, you know, quality control and verifiability checklists. We allow them to upload supporting information and add any kind of notes and additional information that might be relevant. And then the other thing is, you know, assuming they do that, because most organizations who are working on, you know, legitimate carbon footprints are already established in terms of collecting their data. They have established channels for collecting those actual usage amounts and inputting them into the system. The next part is emission factors, and we use kind of the best in class emission factors. And to explain that for those who might not be familiar, to calculate carbon emissions, it's actually quite simple. It's really a two-part formula that gives you your greenhouse gas emissions in units of CO2 equivalent. And it's you take the activity data, so let's say 100 gallons of gasoline burned in a car, you multiply that by the appropriate emission factor, and these are available from governments like the US EPA, Environment Canada, the UK's Department of Environment, Australia's, New Zealand's, European. Like there's these very trusted, established sources for emission factors, and those are all available inside Breeze. And so you take the correct emission factor for the activity. So in this case, it would be gasoline for a car. You would go to DEFRA and you would pull the emission factor for gasoline burned in a car. multiply the 100 by the emission factor, which might be, for example, 5 kilograms of CO2 per gallon. And then you get your end result of emissions, which is just in units of mass, so kilograms of CO2. And so it's really simple. Where it gets complicated is before the data hits the system. So establishing those collection channels, finding who in the company owns that data, what sources are in use, and what might be relevant to greenhouse gas footprint, and then actually collecting that data. That takes a huge amount of time still for most organizations. And then making sure that your emission factors are correct. But then the math itself, the thing that's handled in Breeze, is relatively straightforward. And there are, you know, very established ways of doing those calculations and being confident in the results. And I know that was kind of a long-winded explanation of how the carbon accounting works, but that's what we do to make sure that the underlying data is correct. And then from there, the end result, it's pretty, you know, it's not rocket science to make sure that the carbon accounting result is accurate, the greenhouse gas emissions numbers are accurate.
Right, right. And like, there's certain, like, if someone wants to use their app, it's sort of helping them in their sustainable path, right? You're not really expecting firms that aren't really, right, that don't actually want to make change or actually truly like drop their emissions. You're actually like trying to get clients who actually believe in this, and they're just see Breeze as a tool at which they can help them achieve their sustainable goals and whatnot, right?
Exactly. That's just it. It's a tool. And where it comes in and where it becomes really helpful for that is even if you are a company who's just doing this because one of your large investors has requested scope 1 and 2 disclosures, which is very common, or a government, you know, large customer has requested greenhouse gas emissions disclosures along with other ESG metrics. Even if you're not doing it for sustainability's sake, but for a business reason, we can still interpret the data that you have in the system. Let's say we see you're using natural gas and diesel fuel and electricity, and make specific recommendations for ways that you can reduce those emissions in the future. And that's something that's really exciting that we're really working on building out, is kind of developing this database of useful, proven solutions to reduce emissions, and then using AI to recommend the best ones for the users based on the data that they have in the system, the regions in which they operate, and everything like that. So yes, obviously we want to work with the companies who are innovators, who are, you know, excited about reducing their emissions and making that one of their competitive advantages. But even if you're not, and you're just, you know, even if your company's not interested in that, you can still browse these solutions and actually find ways that have a business case to reduce your emissions.
Right. No, that's really interesting. Sort of the one way I've sort of been interpreting the app is sort of like the QuickBooks of emissions. But that's kind of the way I see it. It's just like when people ask, like I told people that like you're coming on the pod and whatnot, and they're like, so what is Breeze? And that's sort of the best way that I could explain it. But sort of that's just the way I see it, right? It's really like, nice comparison. Yeah, it's like sure. GHD tax time, if you will. Yeah. And then it's just like, it's really cool. It's a really fun app.
You can just sign up, do it yourself. It applies to all kinds of different organizations and it starts free. It's very similar to that for sure. Like those kind of entry-level accounting platforms or, you know, even things like signing up and using a project management tool, it has a very similar kind of experience to that, where you can just create an account, look around, try it out, and grow and expand from there in a really simple way.
Sort of moving the discussion in a different direction, I just want to like sort of pick your brain on like, just because you're very like well-versed in like the community of sustainability, if you will. And I sort of want to get your take on this as sort of like, how can you tell if a business is actually taking action on climate versus if they're greenwashing or whatnot?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. And I mean, I have thoughts on this, but I don't think there's any right answer. And it depends on the organization. So if you're looking at large companies, especially public organizations, companies who are regularly producing sustainability reports or disclosures, I mean, there's a couple different ways, but ultimately it comes down to how well are they quantifying and reporting their impacts. So whether that's actual emissions, whether that's energy consumption, whether that's water, whether that's waste, social impacts, governance impacts, what do their disclosures actually look like? So first of all, do they have any? And if they're just making sustainable claims and they're not actually producing any data to support them, that's a pretty clear red flag. However, with smaller organizations, those who might not be public, might not be producing regular sustainability reports, it also comes down to the justification and how well they're explaining the problem, explaining their solution, and providing some sort of data, whether it's at a product level, an organization level, a systems level, a process level, life cycle analysis. That's the most important thing, is if they can actually prove what they're saying by having some kind of data. For larger companies, where it kind of becomes more interesting, where if you're on the outside of the organization, you can actually get access to their disclosures. Looking at, you know, reading through things like their CDP or Carbon Disclosure Project disclosures, which is a form that they produce publicly to share with investors, and they get scored based on their kind of carbon impacts, carbon actions, strategic integration. Reading through those and actually looking through and seeing how some of them are just absolute garbage and some of them are actually quite compelling and backed by data and supported by the executive level. You know, you kind of have to look at these different indicators of how high in the company does sustainability live? Is this owned by the CEO and board and executive team? Or is this something that just kind of lives with a sustainability function? Are they measuring, collecting and measuring emissions data across the whole organization? Are they reporting it at lower levels, or are they only reporting it at the aggregate? You know, it's, I'm biased in terms of saying data is the best way to tell, but without actual data, it's really difficult to understand whether anything is actually happening, especially over time.
No, definitely. Like, that's something that sort of worries me with, you know, there's like these international sustainable reporting standards that are being released and whatnot. And it sort of worries me that like companies might just like, it might just be more like corporate clutter on like the their reports and whatnot. It sort of worries me that it's just going to be like written with empty statements. And like you're saying, if they have actual measurables and data that they could use to back up their points, maybe it's like, okay, this firm actually has a climate initiative. They're actually trying to make a change with their emissions. And yeah, so it's just like sort of reading through what they're reporting and if there's any like actual materiality to it, I find is really important. And that's, yeah, like I said, that's just sort of something that worries me with, we're saying, okay, like I know in the past year, there's been a lot of development with international standards for companies to report on their like climate impact or whatnot, but it's just like, is there actually going to be some true materiality to this? And, you know, like you're saying, like one way you prove that is with the numbers. It's like, are my numbers better than they were last quarter or last year or whatever? And it's like, I just see like, back to Breeze, right? Breeze is a way of providing those measurables, if you will.
Yeah, 100%. And I agree, there's a lot of development and a lot of what's happening in the world of sustainability reporting, where more and more companies every year are producing these reports. A lot of that is nonsense, fluff, garbage, you know, just kind of corporate communications level stuff. But two notes of optimism there. The first one is about the actual development of standards and the development of how they're working. There was a lot of movement last year from the SEC, so the US's regulatory body that will be responsible for climate disclosures and is also responsible for financial disclosures. They released draft statements, drafts of their proposed regulations for companies to disclose. And in those initial drafts, they said only scope 1 and 2 will be required. Scope 3 is not required. You can report it if you want. And scope 3 is the significant chunk of emissions for most organizations.
Right.
And so that's somewhat problematic in terms of producing the whole picture. And what happened is they released these for feedback and they got more responses than any other regulation has ever received in the past. More people submitted requests, submitted feedback, you know, suggestions than had ever happened before. And so it actually took them quite a while longer than they expected to review it all and make their revisions. But one of the main outcomes is that they actually increased the number of disclosures around data and, you know, proposed many more inclusions of scope 3, as well as more kind of supporting information for that data. So there was a lot of positivity there. And a very similar thing happened in the European Union, where they proposed standards that didn't necessarily include scope 3. And then they were also moved to include scope 3 after getting a record number of responses. So there's a huge amount of interest. And most of that interest is actually directed towards increasing the quality, increasing the verifiability and inclusion of the data in these reporting standards. So that's the first kind of positive note. And the second one, I'm trying not to spend too long talking about data here, but it is something that...
No, go for it. Please, please.
The second thing is that there's an increasing move towards sustainability reporting and data, not just being like essentially an ad that they put on their website where they're not really responsible for the quality of it, where it's just kind of a communications movement. And it becomes something that is an actual, you know, fiduciary disclosure. And so if you're reporting false numbers, you can actually be held accountable and sued by your shareholders and your stakeholders for misrepresenting the facts, because this information is actually relevant to the long-term value of investing in the company. And so when that happens, you get companies, anybody who's public is now essentially having their sustainability data audited by a third party. So all of the big four accounting firms, as well as many smaller firms, are hugely expanding their departments to review ESG data, because every company now has to prove that these numbers are legitimate so that they don't get sued, so that they're not, you know, essentially committing fraud. And then that also means a lot of these companies, like you said, you don't want it to just be like a note to the annual reports where it's kind of, you know, we believe sustainability is a core part of our business, but they're actually including the GHG data, for example, in their financial reports, not just on a secondary report. So if you're an investor and you just want to read how's this business doing financially, you're also going to see their sustainability data right alongside it, because it's that important and taken that seriously.
For sure, without a doubt. Yeah, there really needs to be, like you're saying, that fiduciary duty. Like up till now, it's sort of been sort of the fiduciary duty of any firm is just to provide profits and provide return for shareholders. And just like if we could see sort of sustainable initiatives engulfed within that, that's just really a great way to, you know, push the climate movement forward and actually get like material change within companies' emissions, countries' emissions and whatnot. And sort of what you're saying with like, you know, providing accurate reporting and like following these standards set by the SEC and whatnot. Like, do you see that Breeze can actually adapt to that? And do you see like a long-term vision for where Breeze could actually sort of mold like whatever data you're providing to clients to like specific reporting requirements?
100%. Yeah. So the nice thing about carbon data is that the rules are not made by any particular jurisdiction. The rules, so to speak, of carbon accounting were defined by the Greenhouse Gas Protocol. That's the standard that's been adopted by just about the world over, with a couple small exceptions. And that was created by the WRI and the WCBSD. So like these two UN agencies responsible for business and resources. And so we have this set of rules that is not actually owned by any particular government that says, how do you do carbon accounting? And what's happened is that all of these different jurisdictions who have created regulations for disclosure just say, do it in alignment with the protocol. So Breeze, being built in exact alignment with the Greenhouse Gas Protocol, gives you a resource, your carbon footprint, that can just be taken, exported, and dropped into any of these reporting standards, including anything that might not be owned by a government, but that might be CDP, that might be SASB, that might be GRI. You can report to any of these frameworks using the data kept in Breeze. So we're incredibly versatile. And we've designed it to be future-proof in that way, because I think in the next 10 years, we're going to see a lot of consolidation of frameworks, and that's already starting to happen.
Right, for sure. And sort of that's like the hope, right, is that like there's, like you're saying, consolidation with these reports so that like what you're reading on one firm's, you know, like annual report or whatnot is comparable to another firm's annual report. So you can actually make a true decision about, okay, this firm, maybe their financial performance is relatively similar, they're in the same industry, but okay, this firm has less carbon emissions, or actually maybe they're looking further down the value chain, like you keep saying, like you've mentioned before, is like looking to scope 3. And for anybody that doesn't know, like scope 1, 2, 3 is sort of like a company's emissions that they're responsible for. And the way you interpret scope 3 is that they're not necessarily responsible for it, but they kind of are. Like that's sort of, I don't know.
Yeah. Like they don't have control over scope 3.
Right.
So scope 1 and 2 is emissions that you have somewhat direct control over, with scope 1 being, you know, fuels that you're actually burning in your facilities, and emissions that are coming directly from your building that if you stopped operating would just disappear. Scope 2 are the emissions from purchased electricity specifically, or purchased energy. And so you're responsible for them because you're consuming the energy, but you don't actually control the facility that it's generated in. So you're responsible for the emissions to the extent that you use it, but you might not be able to change that so easily. And then scope three is essentially everything else. And so that's, like you were saying, it's the emissions that are outside of your control, but that you're responsible for to the extent that you're paying for the services that are causing these emissions, or they're in facilities that you're using, but that you don't actually control directly.
No, exactly. Yeah. So like without that firm, there's no scope three emissions on their part, right? Like there's that's not going to happen. And yeah, let's hope to see that scope three, or there's sort of that, like, they're not like separated where it's like, okay, all along the value chain, this firm is held accountable for. I'm not sure if there's anything more you'd like to mention on Breeze.
Yeah, no, thank you. It's been awesome. If I can leave with one note, I think we've spent a lot of time with our heads in the clouds in terms of data and regulation and all this stuff. The most important thing is that this is really just measuring what's actually happening and what actually needs to happen, which is taking the steps to reduce. And a lot of companies, a lot of individuals get to the point where they kind of see their impacts, but they don't really do much to reduce over time. And building those structures and getting every member of the organization excited about reducing and actually becoming a more sustainable organization is ultimately the most important thing. And that's our focus too, is like, if you can be the person in the room or the product in the stack that people go to for help, for excitement, for energy on sustainability, that's absolutely the best thing you can do. And it's the only way that we'll continue being excited and being hopeful for a more sustainable